Hello, friends. We are beginning with the Laws of the Soul webinar commentaries, number 6. We're in the Law of Sacrifice. We're in Esoteric Psychology, Volume 2, page 99. We've been discussing three great beings who manifest through three different planets. And let's say the personality of this third ray life is manifesting through Saturn, Mars, and the Earth. And we're told that the mental body expresses itself, the mental body of this great third ray being, which we are presuming to be one of the three persons of the Logoic Trinity, manifests through the medium of the planet Saturn. The astral body expresses itself through the planet Mars, and the physical body of this being through the planet Earth particularly. There are three groups, apparently, of planets who serve as the personality expression of such beings as we are discussing. Now, if we wanted to perhaps find their a map of this process, we would look here to this particular map, which shows the solar logos and what I presume to be the three great beings, or the three logoi, representing the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit, will, love, wisdom, and active intelligence. And I am presuming that each one of these great beings works particularly through, manifest through three planets on the personality level. And after listing Saturn, Mars, and the Earth, he also lists three others. He doesn't list all nine. I presume there are nine. He lists Uranus, Jupiter, and Venus. And just as Saturn represents the first aspect, I suspect that Uranus does here, in this grouping. And that as Mars represents the second aspect, I presume that Jupiter does, in this grouping. And as the Earth represents the third aspect, I presume that Venus does. Venus is sometimes associated with the monastic permanent atom of our solar logos. It has a very strong monastic content and could be considered related to the third aspect of divinity in that way. Uranus is the home of electric fire. It has a very powerful first ray expression. And it does represent a strongly mental vibration. It is a planet of higher esoteric unfoldment, not in time and space, but in terms of attainment, higher esoteric attainment, than either Jupiter or Venus. So at least for the present ordering, as I understand it, or I'm trying to understand it, I place Uranus for the mental body, Jupiter for the astral body, and Venus for the dense physical, or for the third, for the etheric physical. It's also possible, of course, because Jupiter is the hierarchical, well, let's see, it is the exalted planet for Cancer, which connects with the physical plane. We might be able to reverse the positions of Jupiter and Venus, but still Jupiter has a still higher status, spiritual status, in the solar system than Venus, though Venus, for its age, so to speak, and spiritual status, is the most unfolded of all the planets, having achieved its particular task in a more rapid period than any of the others. Jupiter, though of high spiritual status, and Uranus as well, of still higher spiritual status as a synthesizing planet, both of those are not yet much unfolded in terms of their cycle. Venus is almost completely unfolded. But then we have to realize that it is the lower chakras, in man, of course, and presumably by analogy in the solar system, which unfold before the higher chakras do. So in this particular case, I'm going with the order in which these are presented. I also presume, I also think that Neptune, Vulcan, and Pluto are three more connected with a great first ray life. They all have the power of the first ray. Neptune, not so much in the ray chart, but bringing on the pralaya, which is the final destruction and end of all form. Vulcan with its first ray relating to the heart of the sun, and Pluto again with its first ray. Should we be reversing Vulcan and Pluto? Well, Vulcan is related to the heart of the sun, and Pluto to the underworld. Of course, what is that underworld? It could also be, I suppose, Neptune, Pluto, because Pluto relates to the solar plexus and to the astral plane, and Vulcan, which has a very strong physical plane connection. Pluto with the astral plane, or Hades, and Neptune not so much with the mental plane, but it is the it is one of the destroyers. Well, I can see that there are various ways to arrange these. Suffice it to say, they are, with Mercury, the only planets to which we normally refer, which are remaining. And it seems that the synthesizing planets should be in the first position and related to the highest aspect of the personality. Well, we are speaking of the law of sacrifice, so we don't want to get too far off into other things that relate strictly to cosmology and to esoteric astrology. But I believe that Mercury is not one of these through which a great first ray or second ray being expresses. First of all, it wasn't mentioned in the Uranus-Jupiter-Venus connection, and there's much of the second ray that can be associated with all of them. Even Uranus, as I said, taking the place or in alignment with Sirius and with Pisces, and bringing in second ray energy, which targets eventually in man the heart center and the solar plexus center. Interestingly enough, there is a place where Neptune is associated with the base of the spine center, but I think that's a very special type of connection. I think it's on page 300 or so of esoteric astrology. Let's see if that is the case. Well, I thought it was the case. Let's see if there's anything else right in that vicinity. Yeah, it is. Uranus, the head center. The sun, the head center. Uranus connected with the heart center. So there's another heart of the sun connection for Uranus, another second ray connection, but also one for Mercury as well. And Neptune related to the base of the spine. Well, these are, I've discussed this as I went through the esoteric astrology book, and in a way, at least on the cosmic astral plane, Neptune rules that particular creative hierarchy, which will have its place on the lowest level of the cosmic astral plane, hence the connection possibly with the base in that respect. It seems to be the opposite pole, in a way, of Saturn in this context. Mercury and Uranus oftentimes are found together. One is the higher octave of the other, but their order seems to be reversed. So this is a kind of quizzical chart, but it shows us that even so abstracting a planet as Neptune can find an association with physicality. In any case, on all the different planets, the law of sacrifice is operating in a different manner, and I suppose never so potently or with so much difficulty or producing so much distress as it does on Saturn, Mars, and the Earth, and especially on the Earth. He didn't go any further and say there is a great first-ray being through whom three other planets represent the personality expression. But we can infer that such might be the case. So, as I discussed earlier, when we talk about the mental body, we're talking about the mental body of this great being, and Saturn is a conduit for this mental body. It's a highly monastic planet, but the mental body of this great being presumably is greater than the mental body of Saturn, and the astral body of this great third-ray life is greater than the astral body of Mars, and the physical body, however we would look at that, I wonder if it would entail all the three planets and their physical nature, is greater than the physicality of Earth. So there are mysterious factors going on here, and DK simply introduces them to us, these stupendous lives, and he only really deals with the third-ray life particularly. Seven sacred planets, 10 planetary schemes, because we have to include Pluto we have to include the Earth and yes, Pluto and Earth are both exoteric, yes. And of course here we have to include Mars, so that makes the 10, and there would be 12 when we add the veiled planets, the non-sacred planets, apparently veiled by one by the Sun and the other by the Moon. And we've speculated as to which these might be. We've talked about Adonis, we've talked about Rex. Some of this information found in the book called The Undiscovered Planets by Charles Jayne. He was a great researcher along the psychic lines of astrology and in other ways as well. Okay, so now we can, I think, move on. These facts constitute a tremendous mystery. He's used on almost the same page the word stupendous and the word tremendous. So we're not going to penetrate this, but we can hold it in mind. These are subtler relations of certain planets to three great entities which embody the three aspects of the Solar Logos, and they are called, as I discussed earlier, or at least suggested earlier, they're called the three Logoi, and we find them here. Okay, we're glad that these are in the appropriate colors, and we our gratitude to Keith Bailey and the Masonic Lodge for coloring these in a way that helps us discern the qualities and the lines of contact. So these facts constitute a tremendous mystery and in no way negate the truth that Venus has a peculiar and intimate relation to the Earth. As I discussed, even a human being can have many different types of relations, and so do the planetary Logoi. Some of them are deeply esoteric and some of them are more obvious. So the alter ego relationship of Venus to the Earth stands, no matter what particular configuration Venus may be in when representing a stupendous ray life, probably expressing along the second ray line. DK didn't give us the ray, but when you study closely the involvements of Uranus, Jupiter, and Venus, Venus with its final, we believe, second-ray monad, and Jupiter with its second-ray soul, and Uranus having no discernible second-ray in its nature, but somehow related to these lines of expression which are related to the descent of the second-ray. Okay, so the point here being stressed is difficult to express, but of great importance, so let me be more explicit, he says, by means of the following statement. Only three planetary schemes are aware of pain and sorrow, as we understand those terms. And none of them know it so well or feel it so much as does our planetary logos. Now, he is somewhat specific, but does he mean, then, Saturn and Mars? Because these are the two so-called malefic planets in our solar system, and they are called malefic even though they are not malefic, because they do bring oftentimes conflict, war, lack, privation, and so forth to humanity. Saturn, a very karmic planet, forcing us to face, sometimes through great difficulty, our own necessary karmic adjustments, and Mars causing friction, fire, immolation, war, and all of those things which threaten the forms to which we are attached. So only three planetary schemes are aware of pain and sorrow as we understand those terms. Perhaps there is some sort of exquisite pain and sorrow of a type that we do not understand. At one point, DK talked about the exquisite agony that the hierarchy feels as they observe man making important choices and perhaps missing the correct choice and retarding his own progress greatly. But our planetary logos really is the place of greatest suffering, of the mode of suffering that we know, in our solar system. The purifying sorrow and releasing pain, or is it the other way around? I always get that confused. Purifying sorrow, well, let's see. Yes, it's releasing sorrow, and this is one way to remember it, PP, purifying pain. So one of these categories has two of the same letters connected with it. So it's the planet of releasing sorrow and purifying pain, and it's the agony of the friction caused by the difficult interplay between the third aspect and the second aspect of divinity on an essentially uncompromising first-ray planet. Well, the first ray of the Earth is esoterically non-effective at this time because it's not a sacred planet and it is the monadic ray. But somehow this first ray underlies everything, and we have a great destruction of forms going on our planet, which probably is of first-ray origin. So pain and sorrow arise when desire is unfulfilled, or when that which one desires is taken away. So there is a separation on our planet between desire and its object, and constantly attachments are always being broken or rent or cut on our planet, and this causes the pain of division. It has been said in the Upanishads that wherever there are two, there is fear, but we could also say wherever there are two, there is pain. That would be another way of looking at it. Pain and sorrow are the result, he says, of rebellion and of divine discontent. Well, rebellion is also based on separation, because there is a vision of a more ideal state and a refusal to accept separation from that state. A vision of a higher state of achievement and a willful refusal to accept separation from that ideal state. In other words, the spirit wants to reamalgamate with itself. The spirit is apparently surrounded and separated by that which is not itself, and it wants to return to its own homogeneous, unified nature, and does not accept the apparent separation, hence the rebellion. So if there were no perceived separation, there would be no rebellion. If there were no perceived separation, there would be no rebellion. The instinct to betterment based on, well, what is betterment? This is the approach to the ideal or unified state of spirit. Better and better means closer and closer. Closer and closer to, unity and oneness. So the instinct of betterment based on discontent, or let's just say rejection of the present contact, based upon a rejection of the present content, has necessarily involved the planetary temperament or attitude which recognizes the dualities. Well, let's just say rebellion arises in our case, and probably in general, by the refusal to accept duality and division. Well, we do have a Ray One monad in our planet, and oneness is the goal. Of course, we might be able to speak generally about the cause of rebellion. There is a perceived state or condition, and there is a highly desired state or condition, and there is not acquiescence with the perceived state, which is inferior. So non-acquiescence with the perceived state or condition, which is inferior to the ideal state or condition. So where there are two, there is fear, pain, and rebellion. Fear, pain, and rebellion, all based on two-ness. I think among the Pythagoreans, the number two was not held in such high veneration. They rather preferred the odd numbers. Okay, so what have we arrived at so far? That only on three planetary schemes, and we presume that they are the three which have been the focal point of this little section, namely Saturn, Mars, and the Earth. Interesting, so closely related to the Earth, and yet considered in Earth astrology as a kind of, malefic or destructive planets, and yet so closely related. And that pain, sorrow, and rebellion are the result of rebellion and divine discontent. Kind of interesting that Neptune is a planet much associated with divine discontent. Neptune and divine discontent, always wanting to go beyond the ring pass knot of the present condition. So Neptune finds its way beyond the ring pass knot almost always by legitimate or illegitimate means. And there is a stage to be reached in the human consciousness where that which lies behind the dualities, the stage of essential oneness, can and will be recognized. And let's just say that until this stage of essential oneness is recognized, until this stage is recognized, there will be rebellion and divine discontent as prods towards that state of recognition. So we are subject to great dualism. DK discusses how, well, we're adjudicators between the pairs of opposites on this particular planet, but DK also discusses how Mars is emphasizing the dualistic state, and with Saturn, you always have division. You can choose one way or another, but you can't have both, so you're always faced with the factor of choice. So on all the three planets, namely Saturn, Mars, and Earth, dualism is highly pronounced, and the pain goes along, pain, sorrow, and suffering of the kind we know go along with the perception of dualism. The rending process, the separation is the cause of pain, and unification is the cause of bliss. I think if you think about that in your life, separation from that which you desire is the cause of the pain that you experience, even if it's the pain within the body, you know, a disintegrated state, the separation of one function from another so there is not a harmonious interaction, the separation from our vision or from a person or a state. It's always that gap. The gap is the gap of pain. The gap in dualism is the gap of pain. And it's possible, of course, to live within dualism and not experience pain if your consciousness is already in the state of isolated unity and you realize the dualism to be a perception, an illusory perception, or something that will give way in time. All right, let's go a little farther here. He said it would be abstruse, didn't he? So when this takes place, this merging into oneness, the consciousness of our humanity will then merge with that underlying consciousness of the whole, and the great word of power as follows, to merge with one, with the underlying, already present consciousness of the one, the underlying consciousness of the whole, which recognizes no pain or sorrow and has therefore slipped out of the realization which predominantly governs the consciousness of the three great lives of our solar system. The three great lives in our solar system, and by these three, I assume we mean the lives which are on the third ray in one manner or another, and which are expressions of the personality vehicles of the great third ray stupendous being. So this is the progress, and notice that when there is unification, when the one is achieved by the two, then pain, sorrow are no more. We slip out of this dualistic condition which promotes the realization of pain. So we have three factors operating here. Only three planetary schemes are aware of the pain and sorrow as we understand those terms, and these the pain and sorrow are the result of rebellion and divine discontent, but this is based upon the perception of disunity. A state of oneness is going to occur, and humanity is reaching towards it, and when it is achieved, pain and sorrow, as we know them, will be relieved. And we will be in a position of oneness, unknown and unafraid, untouched, for A, unchanged. Well, it says that of the Great One in the third formula in discipleship too. Pure being is. Well, that is the realization of the one, and isolated unity takes us into that state of realization, and presumably in the isolated unity, there is no pain or sorrow. But there may be a compassion and identification. So certainly the Christ exists in a state of isolated unity, and for him the two have merged with the one, and yet he is in a deep state of love, compassion, and identification with all those for whom this has not yet occurred. Well, all of our sacrifices and the pains of sacrifice are on their way to the oneness. So sacrifice brings us closer to this state of bliss and oneness. And then there is this fifth point. It is this dimly sensed truth which lies behind the highest type of metaphysical thought, such as Christian Science, unity, divine science. He tells us these are all the blend of the sixth and the fifth ray. An intense wish aided by the power of higher mind. And the emphasis laid on Christianity and the esoteric schools upon at-one-ment. So we can say that we are all destined, or, well, headed towards at-one-ment. And the identification, the realization of unity. These are our objectives. And until these are achieved, we will have the, let's call it the pain of dualistic perception. In our life of pure being, which is ultimate oneness, this kind of pain does not exist. But, well, you wonder whether any universe is separable from pain. It seems that the existence of a universe implies dualism, the non-dual, and that out of which the non-dual has come. Apparently in opposition to it, just as one is opposed to absolute infinitude. I've sometimes argued that that which is the greatest distance from absolute infinitude is the one. If that is the zero, then the one is the greatest distance from the zero. The instinct towards betterment through sacrifice is itself diverse, I suppose, different with different ray types and for different people. But that's the idea, isn't it, if you take a look at it? Betterment through sacrifice. This is our theme. And the implication is that without sacrifice, there is no betterment. Well, we oftentimes think that we can achieve betterment in non-sacrificial methods, but we'd be surprised at what we are sacrificing if we really look carefully. Just think of the ambitious person who betters himself through dedication and through extreme focus upon the objective and through the exercise of the will. Look how many things are being sacrificed on that path. Time, sleep, friendships, relationships, many things are being dispersed, sent to the side in the pursuit of that which raises his condition. So there are many sacrifices we are making of which we are unaware, I suppose. Are many sacrifices made of which we are unaware. You know, going back to school days, well, you want to go out and play with your friends, or you might study and improve yourself and get higher marks, leading to a better future. Some people just drop the studies and they go out and they play. Other people have to sacrifice the playing, have to stay at home and study. It is a sacrifice, but it leads to betterment. It's probably a concrete example that every high school student or every university student has experienced. There are so many ways in life in which we choose this for that, and in choosing this for that, we find that there is definitely a relinquishment. Well, it may be a relinquishment we are willing to make because we have the vision of where it will lead to choose this instead of that. But sacrifices are made all the time. It's a question of choice. We are always making choices, and in this very Saturnian world, we can have one thing and not another. Some people want it all, and they find a way somehow to embrace the opposites and sometimes succeed, but usually on the way there, we have to forego, well, you know, the old saying, you can't be in two places at the same time, and it's oftentimes hard to fulfill contradictory desires. One cannot be two places at once, until later at least, and it is hard to fulfill contradictory desires without dividing oneself and splitting the personality, as it were. Sometimes we do find disintegrated people who are very contradictory and who have a personality disorder where two opposing factors seem to live within the psyche simultaneously, but that is a disintegrated state heading for ruin and cannot be long sustained. Okay, so always the instinct towards betterment involves sacrifice. This is such an important theme, something that should really be impressed upon us. I'm thinking here of the Maurya Federation, how much sacrifice of time is required of those students who work through our fairly demanding curriculum. Some hours every day, certainly every week, have to be spent. They might be spent on something else. But the spending of energy, the spending of time, these are the common sacrifices which are perhaps not so much noticed. When relationships have to be relinquished, then perhaps there is more noticing. When life itself has to be relinquished, then you have the person's attention. Okay. There is, first of all, the instinct towards individual betterment, which leads to selfishness at first, to a grasping and to an orientation of the materially minded towards material possession. Well, let's say this is the individualistic approach. Of course, later, some of us as individuals think that betterment would be something that helps the group. It is also possible to better oneself and help the group at the same time. But this is another stage. So at first, we are dealing with the fulfillment of the desires and inclinations of the lunar vehicles. And this is not the same thing as bettering oneself as an instrument which may be of value to the group. So DK is saying the instinct towards betterment through sacrifice is itself diverse. Even when we're trying to better ourselves in the individualistic sense, we have to give up one thing for another. So even then, the implications of sacrifice are not foregone. There is secondly the instinct towards an ameliorating of the condition of other people. First from a selfish motive, the avoiding of personal distress at the sight of suffering, let's say more along the fourth ray line, hatred of causing pain. And secondly, through pure disinterested service, which is a quality of the soul. And we might say that this is more related to the second ray, but not exclusively so. There are selfish people on all the rays, and there are those who serve through pure disinterested service on all the rays. So do we think only of ourselves and of the condition of our lunar vehicles and of that perception in mind which we call the ego, with our eyes upon ourselves, our reputation, as it were, the sense of our own ego, lower ego, and its enhancement? These are all lower things. So this, we're talking here about betterment through sacrifice. There is, so this is, this one is called individualistic betterment, and the other one here might be called, the second one here might be called social betterment. And there are many people who are interested in this, perhaps first from the pain and distress that they see when they look at others in terrible situations, and then simply out of the energy of pure love, pure harmony, and the realization of identification with the other, the realization of spiritual relationship. Then another type of betterment, there's finally the active application and complete sacrifice of the lower separated self to the power to stand in spiritual being, which necessarily, well, you know, obviously this has first-ray implications, which necessarily infers that one has reached that state of consciousness which transcends what might be called symbolically the Earth, Saturn, Mars state of consciousness. And this is the transcendence of the dualistic consciousness, characteristic of Earth, Saturn, Mars. Well, maybe that idea can make itself well known in our consciousness. So we stand in oneness, in spiritual being, and we, as it says in Gemini, we serve the One, service of the One. I serve myself, I serve my brother, I serve the One, Gemini, finally. And this is really the overcoming of the dualities which Gemini represents. So the complete sacrifice as we stand in spiritual being and seek to promote spiritual being in all our environment and within our ring pass knot. We seek to promote it. Well, what is our motive for service? Why do we give up what we give up? Are we, in this case, we would be interested in a consuming manner in the divine plan and in the divine purpose. And our sacrifice would be to see that plan and purpose enacted for the greatest good of the greatest number, because inevitably that will be the case. If the plan and purpose are enacted, then the greatest number will be served, and for them will be achieved the greatest possible good. So When we sacrifice, why do we sacrifice? This is, after all, a book on psychology, and we want to ask ourselves those questions and apply these things to ourselves as, you know, as we go along. Motive is such a key factor. And the masters look at our motive for anything we might do. It's possible to do something that has good effect for bad motive, and something that has bad effect for good motive. The motive is what counts, and of course when skill and action increases, then you do something good with good motive. You succeed in planning the good and in doing the good, such is your skill. Let it not, however, be forgotten that we live on a planet of dualism, and the malefics in our chart, the so-called malefics, they're really benefics, DK tells us, the so-called malefics are that because they enforce the sense of dualism and the pain that comes along with it. You know, Saturn says you can't have it all, and Mars says you have to fight for what you get. So there will be the pain of division in relation to both of these so-called malefic planets. But interestingly enough, they do open the door to hierarchy, Saturn in relation to Capricorn and Mars in relation to Scorpio. Let it not be forgotten that the contribution to these three great planetary lives, as they embody preeminently the law of sacrifice, they embody preeminently. So, you know, where pain and sacrifice are likely to be achieved, look at the placement of Saturn and Mars in your chart. So they embody preeminently the law of sacrifice through pain and rebellion. Let it not, however, be forgotten that the contribution to these three great planetary lives, as they embody preeminently the law of sacrifice through pain and rebellion, is a major contribution to the whole. And I wonder if this word should be contribution to, or should this be of, perhaps. Contribution of these three great planetary lives through pain and rebellion is a major contribution to the whole and greatly enriches the sum total. The path of adversity is needed to strengthen us. And, you know, Master Mori would say that contending with the enemy is a source of strengthening. And similarly, he would say obstacles are possibilities. The units of divine life and the atoms of electrical energy, well, that's what we are. We are atoms of electrical energy. We are units of divine life. We remember in cosmic fire, all these different forms of life are really atoms, apparently self-contained units with their nucleus and their periphery and their relationship between. The units of divine life and atoms of electrical energy who pass through these three planetary schemes are subject to them in order to acquire that psychic sensitivity which would otherwise be impossible. So we can make a generalization here and say that through pain comes psychic sensitivity. Well, it wears away the hard outer shell. We do have that layer or rind in our system, kind of a protective periphery which has to be softened and even rent, even dissolved with no skin, as it were, in order to be sensitive to the environment, maximally sensitive to the environment, you know, such as the Christ, such as Ramakrishna. Whoever has done it unto the least of these has done it unto me, and Ramakrishna crossing the river, hearing the master beating the slave, who's beating me? Who's beating me? There, the outer rind no longer prevents the impact of the environmental vibrations. So to acquire that psychic sensitivity through pain, through sorrow, through loss, which otherwise would be impossible, through pain and, all those undesirable states. Only those units of life who are colored predominantly by the third ray of activity pass for any length of time through these three schemes. So some might come, we might say, some might come for a while and not stay long and be colored by other rays. So a hint is here conveyed as to the prevalence of third ray monads among the sons of men. Now, well, let's say that this has to be straightened out, of course. In our solar system, there are many second ray monads, 35 billion, and only 20 billion third ray monads. But through these three schemes, the majority who stay for a while, how long we don't know, are third ray monads. And this is very interesting. It's always difficult when presented with this figure of 60 billion monads to know whether we're talking about the entirety of the solar system, and we are talking about human monads here, right? Not Deva monads, 140 billion Deva monads. And we wonder if they are the monads of those that are already in some way self-conscious. But there is a prevalence of third-ray monads among the sons of men, and when we are thinking of our monadic rays, we have to think about the likelihood of the dominating third ray. Now, as I have hypothesized, there are two types of monadic rays. And the third ray monad, in a way, may include the fourth, fifth, sixth, and seventh. The monadic ray, I have hypothesized, any one of the seven on the monadic plane, and possibly only three choices on the logoic plane for the liberated monad, the liberated volatile essence, no longer confined to the monadic vehicle or temple of Ezekiel. All of that remains to be discussed and proven or disproven in the future when we can know more about these things. The prevalence of third ray monads among the sons of men. Well, you know, what is your monadic ray? Among DK's group, there were quite a number of, certainly of second-ray souls, and he did speak of a second-ray monad and hinted on a couple of occasions at first-ray monads, but mostly he left the monadic ray undiscussed. He said, well, look, if you work with me for any length of time, and I am your master, and you're going to benefit from my ashram over a long period of time, you're going to have the second ray somewhere in your system, either in the soul or in the monad. But if that's the case, we also have to find a way for there to be a prevalence of third ray monads among the sons of men. So perhaps many of the second ray souls in DK's group, not all, because he showed not all. There was this woman who had a six-ray soul going to the second, and she was also a second-ray monad, so not all. But among those second-ray souls would be perhaps quite a few third-ray monads. I have a feeling, but not knowing for certain, that this was the case for R.S.U., who worked so closely with Alice Bailey, but not necessarily for Alice Bailey herself, who perhaps more like Master K.H. would have the second-ray soul as well as the second-ray monad. That is an inference on my part. With the Christ, I think we have a far more safe inference that his soul ray would be the second, which D.K. says, and since he is an expression of cosmic love, and only the monad can touch the cosmic level, that the second ray monad would be found as well. Anyway, through these three schemes, and one wonders about the proportion of third ray monads divided among these three schemes particularly, which one of the planetary schemes has more. Well, Saturn, you know, has a third ray monad, that's for sure. We don't know the monadic ray of Mars, but it could be the first. It could be the fifth going to the first. And the monadic ray of the Earth is the first. So will that tell us something about the monadic division? The division of third ray monads among these three planets? Well, these are probably mysteries related to higher initiations, and one day when we need to know the numbers, we will know them with certainty. Up till that time, we can speculate. The ray of active intelligence expressing itself through the seven ray types is above all, above everything else, the ray upon which the majority of human monads will, particularly at this time, be found. And one wonders whether we're talking about the major monadic ray or the series, which can be any one of the seven. So are we speaking of the major monadic ray, which I, you know, am I right, am I wrong? I'm not certain yet, of course, but I tend to think of it as the three hovering above the seven, as we see upon or within this chart, the three hovering above the seven, logoic and monadic. So the ray of active intelligence expressing itself through the seven ray types, and, well, this is the first time I'm looking at this. This expression, does it relate to seven soul types or to the seven monadic types on in the seven great circles on the monadic plane? Seven great circles on the monadic plane. There's so many ways that DK can reveal or veil the truth in something he says. He's really a master at having so much Gemini, I think, at revealing and concealing at the same time. So the ray of active intelligence expressing itself through the seven ray types is above everything else. The ray which, upon which the majority of human monads will particularly at this time be found, and does he mean in our solar system? Or at a different stage of unfoldment on our planet, different stage of unfoldment on our planet in this solar system. So does he mean in our solar system or the next? Because our planet will exist in the next solar system as a major chakra, I think, in the solar logos, or at least upholding that chakric function among other functions. Or does he mean that as our Earth unfolds, different monadic ray types will be found prevalent upon our planet? Maybe our planet will become more hospitable to the training of other monadic types once its soul ray, the second, is truly speaking, truly in control. Right now its personality is in control, and maybe that's the reason why the majority of human monads at this time will be found here. Of course, this is the period of achievement. I think the fifth root race is the period of achievement for the monads of the third ray, and I infer, or maybe I've read it, that the period of achievement for monads of the second ray will be the sixth root race and for monads of the first ray, more the seventh root race. But of course, the different rounds can offer also opportunity for achievement. How would that work, however? Fifth round for monads of the third ray, sixth round for monads of the second ray, major monads, and seventh round for monads of the first ray. There are not so many monads of the first ray. Anyway, what we find, I think, at this time is that this is a period of achievement for monads of the third ray. So we shall therefore find the following psychological types coloring the bulk of our humanity in the ray of active intelligence, expressing itself through will, evoking divine purpose, love, expressing divine equality, divine quality, intellect as the reflector of the intuition, that's an important idea, conflict producing harmony. It's interesting how this fourth ray is called the ray of conflict instead of harmony through conflict, sometimes one, sometimes the other. Knowledge of science leading to radiance, and let the soul look out upon an inner world of light divine. It's the most luminous of the ray lords. Idealism establishing the divine pattern on the monadic plane, really. Ritual or organization manifesting deity. There's quite a gap between the sixth and seventh ray. Well, I'll tell you what I'm going to do. I think I've gone far enough with this right now. I'm going to say that this is the end of Laws of the Soul. Webinar commentary is number 6, EP2, and it's going to be on some page or other, page 101. And we'll begin of Laws of the Soul, webinar commentaries 7, EP2, page 101. We'll go on that way. And we'll see whether these seven modes of expression of the monads of active intelligence relate to not only soul types, but perhaps to monadic types as well, because we know very well that there are monadic types on all the seven rays. Just check out page 39. In Letters on Occult Meditation, we'll see the seven great groups on the monadic plane. They're all going to be characterized by a different ray, very definitely. Okay, well, it gets very interesting here. We're in esoteric psychology, but we remember that the kind of psychology we have to understand is not just the personal or individual psychology, but the psychology of the greater beings, such as our planetary logos and solar logos. Okay, that'll be enough on that, and we'll see you soon.